Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to The Art Detective with me, Dr. Yanina Ramirez. I'm an Oxford art historian, a writer and a broadcaster, and I'm your chief investigator of images. Delighted today, this is going to be a fun one, Art Detective listeners, because I'm joined by my colleague and friend, Jonathan Healy, who has the wonderful title of Associate Professor of Social History at Oxford University. It's a very, very posh and important title, isn't it, John?
It does sound very, very posh and important, but I very rarely managed to get to work today to wearing matching socks. It is more posh than I probably deserve, in fairness. Matching shoes, I normally manage. Matching socks is always a bit of a push.
That's good. I have been known to lecture in mismatched shoes.
Oh, that's
good.
It's
a particularly bad day when that happens. But yeah, we're colleagues at the Department for Continuing Education.
Right.
We've known each other for a long time, but we're also friends on Twitter, where you are extremely, extremely funny and make me laugh at least 5 times a day.
That's very, very kind.
And so I said, let's do a podcast. And you said, I want to do...
A podcast.
What pacing you wanted to do?
I would like to talk about The Fight Between Carnival and Lent by Peter Bruegel. Bruegel the Elder. Peasant Bruegel, if you will.
Exactly. Peasant Bruegel, known as the painter of peasants. And as you have discovered today, not the only Bruegel.
No. I was doing my Wikipedia research about 15 minutes ago, and I found out that there's actually way more than one Bruegel. Who knew? Actually, I did know, really.
You did. And all good Oxford academics do use reference materials other than Wikipedia.
It's not true. My lectures are based on Wikipedia, but don't tell anyone.
You've just told everyone. So there's Peter Bruegel the Elder. He is our starting point. But we also have Peter Bruegel the Younger.
Indeed.
Who was one of his sons, who was a bit of a copycat and set up a school to his father afterwards. And then there's Jan Bruegel, who
Indeed.
Is quite interesting and actually quite a creative and fascinating artist himself, but Bruegel the Elder is amazing. So he's a sort of a mould breaker.
Yeah. They were an annoyingly talented 16th and early 17th century family, sort of like the Kardashians, but with talent and skills and artistic ability and intelligence and things like that. But apart from that, just like the Kardashians.
Just like the Kardashians, exactly.
They
even looked like the Kardashians.
I'm sure that's true. I mean, images differ of the Kardashians, but in many of the ones I've seen, they look just like the Bruegels.
Good grief. So you have chosen the Fight of Carnival and Lent, and I imagine this is because you are a militant social historian, is that right?
I'm a very angry militant social historian, yes. I'm constantly waging war against people who talk about kings and battles boring.
Yeah.
Not boring, that's entirely unfair. Some of my favourite kings are quite interesting. The great thing about this painting and the great thing about Bruegel's work is that it is full of life, and it's full of social life, it's full of ordinary people. There's nearly 200 people in this painting, and I'm pretty sure none of them is a king or a celebrity or anything like that. They're all kind of peasants, and I love the amount of everyday life, ordinary people. You can see things like people working, you can see things like people canoodling in inns, you can see people enjoying plays, playing music, all this kind of stuff. And it's a very kind of democratic kind of art, which is what I love so much about it.
I did have a feeling you would pick something like this. And I have to say, I mean, I side with you completely because I'm a cultural historian. And so, again, I get a bit fed up of hearing the endless tales of Henry VIII and all the same things that we're told about.
We're going to get in trouble for this.
We are. Hey, it's only between you and me, Jonathan. But yes, it's an amazing scene of the cross-spectrum of society. And it is incredible, I think, and fascinating to modern viewers, because this is painted, what is it, 1559?
Yes.
So Bruegel himself is born around, we think, 1520, 1530. We know he enters the guild between the ages of 21 and 26. We can sort of guess when he was born, but we don't know for a fact. There are bits written about him. There's a whole biography written about him, which is fascinating. And he is a really interesting character. He moves around. The one thing I love most about him, and you'll appreciate this, like many Netherlandish artists, he went to Italy.
Yes, yes.
So we're talking post-Michelangelo, post-Leonardo. The Renaissance has happened. But he goes to Italy, and while everyone else is painting ruins and classical scenes, he just sits there painting mountains, and then he goes back to more mountains. He's like, yeah, I've done Italy. It was boring. I want to paint some peasants.
Yeah, man after my own heart. Peasants and mountains, that's basically my main interest.
But so it's the vibrancy of this that attracts you.
Yes.
But I imagine it's also because of the climate that is producing this sort of what looks to be social unrest. Tell me a bit about the time that
The 16th century is a period of the reformation of the Christian church. So, I mean, there is a kind of obvious undertone to a lot of the art of this period of religious unrest, religious uncertainty. We're just a couple of generations away from Martin Luther, and we're actually just only a few years away from the Great Revolt of the Netherlands, which was something which was, you know, literally happening right on Bruegel's doorstep, which was, you know, a large part of that was about a Protestant society trying to rebel against a very, very Catholic monarch, Philip II of Spain. There's a sort of wider relevance here, which is partly religious, but also very, very, very cultural, which is that the painting is about sort of popular custom, which are sort of tied into religion. It's about Lent and it's about Shrove Tuesday, Mardi Gras, Fat Tuesday, as they call it in French. But it's also a period of very significant social upheaval. The population of Europe is growing. This causes pressure on resources. It causes pressure on food. There's various kind of, you know, cultural changes, which mean that the social elites are increasingly trying to regulate the lives of ordinary people in towns in Europe, including in England. Kind of urban elites are actually, you know, in some places trying to stamp out the kind of disorder that you see in this painting. And that's partly religious, it's partly because they're influenced by Calvinism and the desire to reform the manners of the horrible poor people. But it's also partly because towns are growing, because the population is growing, because there's increasing problems of poverty, and poverty is represented in this painting, which is another reason I think it's so fascinating.
Yeah, that's what you did your research on, wasn't it?
I did, yes.
Go the poor.
Well, I wrote about poor people engaging with the state and sort of saying, well, I am poor and I should have poor relief because of all these kind of poor conditions that I'm in. But one of the really interesting things about this painting, from my point of view as a historian of the poor, is the depiction of poverty and the depiction of the poor, and also the depiction of charity towards the poor. You know, so just to say something about the nature of the painting, because we should probably sort of describe what's in it, shouldn't
we? That's it. I know.
In this internet age, I'm sure that any listeners are sort of, you know, frantically
Googling.
Well,
the clever team at History Hit embed the images into the podcast. So if you do want to look at it, it will be alongside your podcast download.
It's amazing what they can do these days.
Magic.
But the painting is a depiction of, it sort of does what it says in the title. It's a fight between Carnival and Lent. And Carnival is personified by a rather large chap riding on a barrel with a skewer of meat and wearing a pie for a hat. And if anyone says to me, oh, why do you love this painting? I say, well, it's impossible not to love a painting which has a guy with a pie hat.
There are elements of Bosch coming through, aren't there? And I know the comparison's often made between Bruegel and Bosch, but it's very, very different, isn't it? Because with Bruegel, everything has a meaning. And actually the meaning is quite accessible. You can tell what's going on here.
Yes.
There's a wonderful painting he does where every single character is a different proverb or a different saying. And that is amazing. You can still unpack all these little folk stories that come through. But you're right. So you've got the pie hats man.
And you say it's easy to unpack, but I mean, I've no idea what half of it means. So you've got the pie man on the left, and on the right, he is fighting a battle with the personification of Lent. And I think I'm right in saying this, a woman. Lent is normally a woman. It's in female dress of the period, although it's not entirely clear.
It's not sure. I've heard it described as a man.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's almost one social norm too many to have the head of the Lenten procession dressed as a man, but we'll see. But that's certainly dressed as a nun.
Yes, yes. And Lent is carrying a sort of pallet of fish, which she or he is jousting with Carnival with his kind of skewer of meat. I mean, it works in a kind of allegorical sense in that traditionally, once you'd eaten all the meat of carnival, then you would move into Lent, and it was a period of fasting and a period of abstinence. But actually, these kind of mock battles did literally take place. This was part of the festivity. And usually it would end, well, almost always it would end with carnival being defeated, possibly put on trial, and then possibly, you know, given a mock execution. And the symbolism is, of course, that, you know, it's the end of this period of exuberance and excess, and you are now moving into a period of abstinence. So it's that contrast which is depicted in the painting. And one little sort of nugget, if you look at the top of the painting, in the top left-hand side, on the carnival side, there are trees which are bare. And this, of course, represents the time of year. This is the winter when the trees are bare. And if you then move over to the right-hand side, which is the Lent side, there are a set of trees which are spouting buds. And so it's a kind of movement in time as well. And it's moving from one period of excess to a period of abstinence, which is also representative of spring. Also, if you look on the left of the painting, there is a tavern. Taverns are where naughty things happen. And on the right, there is a church. And a church is, you know, obviously symbolic of religion, but also the religious kind of, you know, elements to Lent. So there's an awful lot going on.
There's definitely a sort of split down the centre of this. And you could see it as two processions.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, you've got the procession behind Mardi Gras, behind the fat Tuesday.
Yes.
And actually, he's interesting because I think he's a butcher. He's got a butcher's knife around his waist. And I think that all of the animals had to be slaughtered in the run-up to Lent. And then butchers would actually go away over the spring to find more cattle. So they would actually leave the town. So there's the sense in which the butcher is slaughtering the meat. They will feast. But as you say, it's split in half. And because on the other side, on the right-hand side, it seems to be more pious and more somber, the characters that are coming out of the church. But there isn't a sense in which Bruegel is saying those people on the left are behaving awfully and really badly, and those on the right are the pious, good Catholics, you could say. There's a much more sort of bird's eye view of this, which seems to be trying to stay impartial, doesn't it?
Yes. Well, I think so. And I think the way Bruegel, and I think the way a lot of people at the time would have thought about this, was that these are two sides to the human condition. And actually, 16th century Europe was an incredibly ordered society. People knew their place and they were supposed to be deferent. And, you know, things went, there was, you know, we talk about a great chain of being from God through the king or queen and through the kind of, you know, church hierarchy right down to peasants. And this was represented in the family as well, where the father was supposed to be like a king in the household.
It's fascinating when he paints children, because he does a lot of paintings of children. He's got some of the first representations of children at play in particular.
Yes,
but it's amazing because he completely homogenises them. They're all mini adults. And they're all playing with things like pig's bladders. They don't have actual toys. But there's this wonderful sense in which children, life was short, child expectancy was low. And so actually you didn't idolise your children. You didn't look at them through rose-tinted spectacles. They were small adults who were below their parents and below the rest of society.
Yeah.
And eventually they'll find their place.
Yeah.
But Bruegel seems to capture that as well, doesn't he?
Yeah, I mean, although that's something that historians have argued a lot about. And you know, there were historians who sort of said, well, children died all the time, so people didn't really care about them. If you read people's diaries, they really did
care. I'm sure they did care about them.
but you know, the idea of adolescence was not something which was particularly well-formed, if it was formed at all in this period. So, you know, children, in many ways, were kind of seen as small adults. And, you know, famously, if you look at a lot of paintings in this period, children are usually depicted in fairly adult clothes. But I wanted to just go back to this idea of the social order. And one of the great things about carnival, one of the reasons historians like me find it so interesting, is that it is a period of misrule, specifically misrule, and it's all about overturning the social order. For example, in the painting, if you look, I can't remember where they are now, but there is someone dressed as a bishop.
Right.
And this is reflective of the tradition of... Well, we've now lost it.
We're now lost the bishop.
Definitely.
There are 200 figures. We're finding our way through.
But
there's a bishop to show that it's sort of the subversion of the church.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
What do you hold to this idea that in some ways a representation of the conflict between Protestants and Catholics that's taking place? Because that's one argument, isn't it? That the left-hand side is Protestant, the right-hand side is Catholic. Catholics all pious and overzealous. Yeah. And I mean, I love the idea that actually... This is awful, but you're like this. In the bottom right-hand corner there, so you've got the procession of rich people coming out the main entrance of the church, and then the poor are having to leave out the side with their own chairs because they didn't have their own chairs. But the idea that these people are being shown to be charitable because Lent was a time of giving alms, that actually everyone's taking advantage of it. So this woman has dragged out her child and her drowned husband's corpse to get more pity, to get more money from the people leaving church during the procession. So it's almost saying that that sort of overt piety, it can be critiqued as well, that that way of life isn't a good, necessarily an answer.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a kind of performative charitableness about some of the way that, you know, these wealthy people are very much giving, you know they are giving money to the poor in a very ostentatious way. I mean, in this period, there is a huge amount of concern amongst kind of huffy middle-class people about the fact that, you know, poor people are basically kind of, you know, taking them for a bit of a ride. You know, some of the debate about charitable almsgiving as a way of salvation, as a way of getting into heaven, it does centre up on this. And, you know, one critique in Wittenberg, for example, the reformers in Luther's time tried to stop students begging because they didn't think begging was a very good way of distributing money to people who actually needed it, because you gave money to the people who asked the most vociferously. And there is a lot of concern in this period about poor people basically kind of, you know, hamming it up a little bit and you know, alms going to people who are not deserving. That said, if you look at the depiction of poverty in this painting, I mean, it's very much, you know, people with very obvious disabilities. It's, you know, in the bottom right, it's someone who is able to drag out their husband's corpse. Yeah, okay, they are performing something, but they're also a widow, and widows are absolutely central to, you know, the understanding of the period of the deserving poor. And, you know, there's a sick child in the bottom right. So I think we can overplay this kind of thing. I mean, I do like the idea that it's sort of satirizing Protestants a little bit. And I say this because there is a strand of kind of Catholic satire against Protestantism in this period, which basically takes the idea of the world turned upside down, which is absolutely central to Carnival and the Carnivalesque, and says Catholicism or traditional religion is the kind of ordered way of doing things. It's how we've always done it. And these horrible Protestants with their, with their, you know, news books and with their sermons in English and with their, you know, translations of the Bible and all this nonsense, what they are doing is they are turning the world upside down. And one of the lovely ironies of that being, and this is why I think the analogy works really well, is that those Protestants were often at the forefront of attacking Carnival traditions because they didn't believe in Lent.
Exactly.
Although, I mean, Luther did.
The Calvinists didn't believe in Lent. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that, I mean, this whole idea of the world turned topsy-turvy is the best way to make sense of images like this by Bruegel. Yeah. And one of the things that's amazing about the bird's eye view that you get in a Bruegel painting is that he is elevated, looking down and casting this sort of satirical eye over the proceedings. Can you see right at the very back of that window there?
Yeah.
There's a character that doesn't, he seems to be on the outside of the window, isn't doing any of the actions that the others are doing.
Yeah.
So it's possible that we, the viewer, are also being asked to take a sort of a bird's eye view. But I think this idea of satire is really important at the time, because what we have to remember is under the Reformation, art and culture changed so radically as well, because when you remove the patrons of monasteries, bishops, churches, other sorts of art had to be provided. And there's this whole period, particularly in the Netherlands, where they're trying to work out what Protestant art can look like. It can't show the saints, it can't, it can still moralize, but should it be moralizing in a satirical way? And I think Bruegel is absolutely at the forefront. He's the first generation of those sorts of Protestant artists. He does actually have a cardinal as one of his patrons. So he is serving the Catholic Church on one hand, and on the other, he's big in with the humanists of Antwerp. He's sort of in this circle where it's all about breaking down the old statues, pulling down the old art. So I think that this is sort of a way of exploring society, but it's also a new sort of art, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the other thing about Bruegel's kind of immediate environment is, you know, working in Antwerp, which at this point is an incredibly vibrant an economically important city. He is playing to a certain extent to an urban audience, and you know, many of these people will have actually had sort of backgrounds in the countryside, so there may be an element of nostalgia. But another theory is that there's an element of kind of, you know, looking down on the silly peasants from the countryside. And you know, two things that sort of strike you about that is there's a central figure in the painting which is a kind of peasant couple right in the middle, and there's actually quite a strong light on them, which is very interesting. And
they're they're just off center by the side of the well, aren't they?
It's a well, and then there's a fish preparation table. I'm not sure what the technical term is, but I'm going to go with that. And the light is very much shining on this couple, and they're a very ordinary kind of peasant couple, and they're being led away by someone who looks a bit like who is dressed like a traditional fool. And it may well be that there's a bit of symbolism there about the kind of, you know, the folly of the common people.
But also, she's got a lit lantern in the middle of the day, which is another sign of folly. Why would you need a lit lantern? So there's a whole suggestion on this side, certainly of folly, but also of distrust, because the yellow character behind the butcher, the carnival character, yellow is traditionally a colour of deceit in these images. And there is a sense in which people are being deceived. So in the bottom right, where you had the widow and her deceased husband, in the bottom left, you've got two people casting dice. One of them's got waffles stuck in his head. I know, you've got pie hat and waffle hat. So this is my kind of land.
Only in Belgium.
And he's casting a die with the devils.
Yes.
So there's a sense in which that there's, you know, deceit and actually an immorality going on that side as well.
Yes, and there's a lot of sexuality in there as well. We focused on the butcher. And if you look, and I know this is a PG-13 kind of podcast, but if you look closely at the butcher, you will notice that he has a rather prominent codpiece.
Yes.
And
we're not averse to talking about the male male and female genitalia on this podcast. Don't you worry. This is art history, my dear.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of them in art.
There's a lot of willies. I mean, this is partly a kind of trope about butchers who, of course, made sausages, which are inherently sexual. Butchers were often seen as quite sexual characters. But it's... I don't know about your feelings about butchers, but I can't get enough of them.
They're the sexiest beasts. They really are the sexiest of men.
And, you know, one of the traditions that you might come across in carnival is a sort of 50-foot sausage being paraded through the town. There are often, you know, people might wear masks with very prominent long noses, which are a kind of phallic kind of thing. And there's a really interesting tent. I say that advisedly because there are very few tents which are genuinely really interesting. This is one of the more interesting tents in Western art. And
from the many.
From the many tents.
Our
next book.
Tents in art.
Tents of Western art.
This is a particularly interesting tent on the left-hand side.
So it's just outside the inn, and it's a representation of a play called The Dirty Bride. And if you look just outside the tent, there is a... Well, I mean, there's no other way of putting this. There is a dirty bride. She is...
A nudie woman.
She's just mucky. Yeah, and then she's being led
astray
by...
There's a nudie person on a barrel further back as well.
There's some nice
sort of nude characters.
My take on this is that this is a representation of carnival traditions of of cross-dressing, which is often a very central part to the kind of festivities around carnival. And again, this kind of plays on this idea of the social order being overturned. One of the ways that you mocked someone who was theoretically overturning the social order was you might dress up as if it was a man. And let's face it, you know, a lot of the most sort of influential kind of religious people in this period, not all of them, but a lot of them were men. One of the ways that you would mock them is by dressing up as them, but dressed up as a woman. And if you really wanted to hammer it home, then you would have them dressed as a bride, and then they would marry someone. The satire here is again this kind of the idea that transvesticism and kind of what we might call kind of gender questionable marriages, these are ways that people at the time satirized the authorities.
It's transgressing, isn't it? And it's where they're going to potentially go into the tent.
Yes.
And there will be this consummation.
Yes.
But I mean, the idea that there are plays going on all over this, because there's little ones outside different buildings as well that you can identify.
Yeah,
this
yeah.
is a place of performance. I mean, even now we have wagon plays, the mystery plays. We know that Christianity had to be interpreted inside the sermon and inside the church, but it also got taken out onto the streets because it was so ubiquitous. Mm. So these are peasant versions of moralising stories and saints and sinners and all the rest of it. And Bruegel loves that. That's what he loves to paint in his art, doesn't he?
But actually, the morality of a lot of these kind of peasant performances were very much kind of bought into the social order. They weren't necessarily challenging it. And one of the really, and it's quite a subtle argument, one of the really interesting arguments about the importance of carnival is that what it does is it allows people in positions of poverty and relative powerlessness to challenge specific figures who are in positions of power. But by doing that, it allows them to sort of get off steam, and it humiliates certain people who have acted badly. But what it doesn't do is it doesn't actually challenge the social order itself. It's a form of quite conservative, actually, bloodletting or letting off of steam. And people use similar kind of terms at the time to describe this kind of thing.
There's the physical bloodletting. I mean, with the sacrifice, there's this wonderful centrality to the composition where you've got the well in the middle. Mm. As you mentioned, there's the fish preparation zone.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there's the slaughtering of the pig taking place on site. Yeah. And this is representing that the meat will be prepared and feasted upon on Mardi Gras, but that the people will only have pretzels and mussels and herrings to live on during Lent. Mm. But yeah, like you say, like the volcano explodes and it's coming together in this composition in that battle between the two figures. But at the heart of it is this well of purity, that it will all go back to something a bit more wholesome, something a bit more steady. And also, I suppose, as well, about the passing of the seasons, this idea that this is a seasonal activity that goes with the flow of human nature and nature itself.
One of the things I find really interesting about this painting is the noise, particularly on the left-hand side. And if you look at the performance of the play, The Dirty Wife, The Dirty Bride, sorry, there is a lady who is banging on some kind of kitchen implement, I think. I'm not quite sure what it is. And what she's trying to do here is she's trying to create something called rough music, which is often a central part of these kind of sort of rituals of discordance. And often what you would have is you would have some kind of discordant thing happening, let's say a transvestite wedding or, someone being mocked as a kind of fake bishop or something like that. And while they were in that sort of discordant position, there would be the banging of the pots and the pans, and it would make all this kind of horrible discordant noise. And then when they were sort of cast out of the town, or when the mock bishop was defrocked or something like that, or when carnival was put on trial and executed, then the rough music would stop. And if you look in the right hand side of the picture, there are no musical instruments, there's no one banging anything, it's a quieter scene. So I think it's very hard for us historians, particularly looking at visual sources, to understand the sounds of the past. But I think noise would have been, this is a bit ironic because we've just been sort of sat in this room while people are banging things outside, but noise is absolutely central to the way that people marked carnival and then marked the transition to the harmony and the quietness. And they would use that word, the quietness meant peace, of Lent, And I think that comes across in the painting as well.
Absolutely. I think the reason that Bruegel is so timeless and that everybody enjoys his... I think they really enjoyed... They were very valued in his lifetime. He was collected, he was appreciated. And it's because of the full set of senses that are aroused. So you do get the sense of touch, of smell, of sight and sound. But I think what's also absolutely amazing about this one, which I'm so glad you chose this one, is because it's almost working like a comic book. It's almost like a temporal passage where you do have a sense in which time is moving from one side of the painting to the other. And even the colour palette, you go from these sorts of red hues and blues and yellows over to this darker shade of the church. And so I think it is as if time is unfolding before your eyes as well. So it's a magical piece.
Absolutely.
Do you know, we have talked at length. We've done our half hour, my dear.
Have we? Oh, well, fantastic. Have.
And there's still so much to say.
Yeah.
I mean, just to analyse the food in this is such fun. I've had such fun sort of choosing what I'm going to have for lunch on the back of looking at a Bruegel.
Yes, if you look very, very carefully, there's someone's holding an M&S sandwich.
Oh, and that's me. That's mine. Yeah, that's got my name on it. It's been so good talking to
Brilliant.
You.
Really,
you
really
are on
fun.
Twitter, and your handle is...
Social History Ox.
Social History Ox. And he's so good to follow. Full of interesting information and humour. I'm also on Twitter. You can follow me at Dr. Yanina Ramirez. And if you've enjoyed the podcast, you can subscribe by going to historyhit.com/artdetective. We've got a big guest coming next week as well. Some exciting announcements to come. And you can also encourage the work that History Hit are doing by going to historyhit.tv. Fantastic new project, which we'll see... History Channel on demand. You can dictate what you want to see on your screen. So stay tuned. Lots of exciting things happening. Thanks again so much, Jonathan. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.